Let's get this meeting started. I'd like to call this meeting to order. Thank you all for joining us. Looks like we have four of us here currently on the board present, so we do have a quorum. I think Paul will be joining us a little bit late, and then Pat is not able to be here today. So looking at our agenda here, I'd actually first like to make a statement about property owners' rights. A property can be nominated by someone other than the owner, but the law requires that owners must be notified of this nomination. The notification cover letter provides instructions on how private property owners can concur with or object to the proposed nomination, and the law allows them the right to object to listing of the property and request a contested case hearing. And that's just general for all projects that come before a board. So our first item on the agenda would be approval of today's agenda. Does anybody have any comments or like me to make any amendments to our agenda today? Okay, can I have a motion to pass the agenda as it was given to us?
So moved.
I'll second.
Okay, all in favor of approving today's agenda? The four of us voted yes. Okay, and then our minutes that we got for the November 19 meeting minutes. Anybody like to make any corrections or statements? Okay, motion to pass those minutes.
So moved.
You're all second. Thank you. All in favor of approving the minutes? Okay, that's passed. And nomination to be considered today. Let me just check, Dr. Diner, did you have anything else you wanted to mention at the start of today's meeting?
I do not, unless you have questions for me.
No, thank you.
Welcome, okay. Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
We just got started.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, okay. I had somebody else run the other meeting.
Thanks, Paul. Okay, our first nomination to be considered today is the La Pietra Townhouses to be presented by Don Hibbard. It's all yours, Don.
Thank you. It says host disabled participant screen sharing.
Hey, Chandra, or I think it's Chandra that's in charge of this. Can you let him share?
Okay, Don, go ahead.
Thank you.
Chandra, are you still doing that because of our, I think that was our first Zoom meeting where we got Zoom bombed?
Yes, I'm still trying to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Okay, thank you.
That was exciting.
Okay, so the first nomination is La Pietra Townhouses. This is a multiple property nomination, and the property is around La Pietra Circle. I just thought we don't do multiple property nominations very often, so I thought I'd just talk a little bit about that. Essentially, there's two types of multiple property nominations. There's ones that are considered to be thematic, and there's ones that are considered to be geographic. This one today will be a geographic one. We have around seven multiple property nominations on the register already. We have several thematic ones. There's the fire stations of Oahu, which discussed all the fire stations. We also have the Tudor houses of Oahu, which I think Angie added a house to not too long ago. We also have thematic nominations for schools by each county. And Lorraine did a thematic a number of years ago, a few years back, on Japanese temples, which I'm not sure if the board ever acted on, because at the time she didn't present any temples and they were confused as to whether they could do the nomination without having any properties in it. Some point we probably should consider doing that, because there's around four or five temples on the register now. Geographic, you're maybe familiar, but you probably never saw the umbrellas. Ross Stevenson, when he's doing the nominations for Honaka'a, they are all under the Honaka'a multiple property nomination. Also, I think he's doing another building tomorrow for that. Tomorrow, I'll be doing a house in Manoa that'll be part of the College Hills multiple property nomination. We also did a number of years ago, Halau Lani Place in Hilo, which was a small street, which was a subdivision. Not all the people wanted to be registered. So we just picked the ones that did and made that a multiple property nomination. Multiple property nominations are different than districts in that each property is individually listed rather than just being listed as part of a district. And essentially what happens is you prepare the umbrella document and then all the other properties fall under that. And like when I do the College Hills, I'll always refer, this is significant for its association with College Hills and refer you to the multiple property nomination, as opposed to having to write it out all over again. So that's what we're dealing with today, is a multiple property nomination. And so we'll be doing the multiple property nomination, the umbrella plus 10 units will be also considered. The umbrella document, the major parts of that includes a historic context statement. In this case, the historic context for this property is the development of townhouse condominiums in the 1960s in Hawaii. Then there's another section called the associated property types. And this, you'd list the different types of buildings that are being considered. For this point in time, all we're considering is dwelling units. There are several other associated property types that could be considered. There's a manager's office and residence. There's a swimming pool. There's a guardhouse. None of those are being considered today, but if at some point in the future they're going to be registered, we'd have to write up an associated property type for that type of building. Then under that, there's a description of the property type, in this case, the dwelling units, and then the significance statement for the dwelling units. And what I'm registering the dwelling units under is two criteria. Criteria C for architecture, and then criterion A for community development, but more specifically townhouse development and historic preservation. This is the first time I ever tried doing something for historic preservation, because not too many properties are over 50 years old yet. So I'm sort of curious about that. Another section of the multiple property umbrella is registration requirements. And this lists out what the property has to have in order to be considered eligible for the register. And then there's just several other small things, the geographical data. This is the area that's being looked at, the summary of survey methods, and then the major bibliography references. For La Pietra, the year it actually was conceived in 1967, but it didn't finally get built until 1971 when it was finished. The architect for the project was Honolulu architect Louis Purcell. The landscape architects were out of San Francisco, a worldwide known company, Ekbo, Dean, Austin, and Williams. Don Austin was the partner who was in charge of this project. And then the developer was Burt Williams, who had development experience before in Los Angeles and also in Texas. The property lies between La Pietra School for Girls and Kapi'olani Park on its lower boundary. There's a road on this side, and actually the park also encompasses the other side. The property that is being considered is all of this. There's essentially the road, La Pietra Circle, which comes in from Honeymoy Street and makes a loop, a little side and then goes back out. It's a one-way circle. There's 19 duplexes in the on the whole property and 38 units. We're going to be looking at 10 of the units today. These two, which is one duplex, these two, which are another duplex, half of a duplex, half of a duplex, half of a duplex, this duplex, and this half of a duplex. I'm just going to run you so you can get a general feeling for the area. I also want to emphasize, I have a suspicion this may be one of the few, if not the only, townhouse complex in Hawaii that we register. The main reason is that it is duplexes, and because it's duplexes, it is eligible for the property tax abatement. And that was one of the motivating factors. The other big motivating factor was that the board wants to have control, or at least more control over people trying to make changes, and they feel they can use, it's on the register, we have to preserve this the way it is. So I think there's two motivations here for this. Here is the driveway coming in from Ponemoi. You have two duplexes right here at the beginning. This is the overhang for the manager's office. The area is characterized very much, it feels much more residential than many townhouse developments today. You have a front lawn area, then you have the duplexes, and duplexes are one recessed, one projects. Each of the units have their own roof, which in many cases townhouses do not. Then you make a turn and you come up, La Pietra's on the right, and this is a straight run uphill with houses, units all along here, and another at the top. At the top, the road goes downhill, and here you can see it coming down, and the houses on either side. And then at the bottom, it makes a turn. Here is the little road that goes off, which is actually also considered part of La Pietra Circle, and it has three duplexes on it as well. And then the road starts to wind its way out of the townhouse complex. Very much reminiscent, I think, of early 20th century suburban design, where you have curving street, narrow, with all the property lines going out to the street, no fences, but rather lawn going out. And then here it is going out and looking back the other way just before we exit. So that's essentially what the property, very lushly landscaped. They said the Dillinghams had quite a bit of influence on design, talking to the developer, talking to the architect, not only on the landscape, but also on the dwelling units being constructed. They wanted something that was appropriate to Hawaii. The dwelling units themselves, like I said, there's two units in every building, a duplex, that are each under their own roof, a hip gablet roof. First floor is lava rock. The second floor is horizontal lap siding. The houses have windows on one side, on both sides, actually. And these are floor to ceiling sliding windows and fixed windows. Here you can get a better view. This is the living room is on one side of the unit, and the living room has floor to ceiling sliding doors at both ends of it. Up here is fixed windows. The house is balanced but asymmetric in that you have the entry to the right of center. And then over here, there's a bedroom with a pair of sliding windows. Upstairs, there's bedrooms which have sliding doors, floor to ceiling, which open out onto a balcony. and on both the front and rear, they have the balconies. Some houses have balconies that go partway across. Some have gone all the way across. But they're all the same design. Similarly, the original doors are on the houses. And this house, this is the original paving on the entry lanai. The homeowners do have authority to make changes here. And so a number of them have changed the material at this point. But the essentially the exterior of the building is under the control of the Homeowners Association Board. And so anything that is going to be changed on the exterior has to get the approval of the board. And the board has retained Jeff Nishi as a consulting architect. And so all these proposed design changes go through him as well. And the present board was very much wanting to keep the historic character of the buildings. And again, that's one of the motivations for registering now. They will have one more argument in their favor for not changing. Here's the doors. They have their thumb latch. Some changes have happened on the exterior. You'll see in several slides later on, when the townhouse was first built, there were no carports. So everybody had open parking. And then in 1982, they hired George Hogan to design carports, which I think were done in a very sensitive manner, very low, same materials, and not obtrusive. You'll notice that as we go along. Other changes, in 2007, the balconies were deteriorating and they hired Jeff Nishi to redo. He redid this original slats, so in kind. The railings were originally metal. They weren't quite this design, but they were close. This is as close as he could get to an original design. And I think it's a very unobtrusive design that blends well. The other major change was the roofing materials. Originally, these were shake. And in 2017, they went to a Euro Shield. It's actually a rubber. And again, I think here is fairly close. It's even hard at this distance to read that it's not shake, although when you're close, you can see it's rubber. But from the street and it's up high, you don't notice that at all. And I think it's a good solution. I just wanted to mention this building. This is the Tahitian across from Kapi'olani Park. It's the only apartment building that we have on the register. This is a co-op. I registered this in 2010. I don't know if any of you were on the board at that time. When we registered this entire building, again, the board was very much in favor. Co-ops are slightly different than condominiums in that the co-op owns the entire building. Each individual owner is a shareholder in the co-op, but the board essentially has total control, but they also don't want to have arguments. And so again, they wanted to register the building to try and help protect it. They were concerned that somebody might buy a couple of units and just infill the whole walkway here. When we did register it and was successful, there was tremendous leeway on the interior. There's no apartment in this building that is original. Many of the lanais, which face out on the ocean, I'm sorry, I couldn't find my photo of it, have been glassed in. Most all the kitchens, living rooms, bedrooms have all been altered. I could find bits and pieces of shoji that were part of the original closets and things, but that was about it. But the board felt, that this, with interiors, you have to have a lot more leeway with apartments and condominiums. And I think that's true with this as well. This is the original floor plan, or one of them. There's two or three, but this is pretty much standard what I find going in. You have your front entry, which is the double doors. You have a hallway that runs down this side to the dining and kitchen area. There's a little foyer here, which opens into the living room. The living room at both ends opens on lanais, although this is a very abbreviated one. And the dining room also opens on lanai this way. There's a bedroom to the left on the hallway. There's a powder room. The bedroom has a bathroom. This is a closet or laundry room. Upstairs, there's a straight run and then a little hall that goes to one bedroom on this side, one bedroom on that side. The living rooms originally were two-story, 17-foot high ceilings. Many of the people have put a mezzanine in here, making a sitting room on this side. So that's one alteration which I feel is acceptable. Many of the units have that alteration. I've also found something with the stairs didn't work or was poor quality, but almost, I haven't found any original straight run staircases yet. Also the finishes, originally the walls were done with teak panel, veneer panels, and I have not seen that anywhere yet. I think maybe one bedroom has it, but I'm not sure. I'll show you that later on. It's one of the ones we're doing. So those are some of the changes that have happened. Another change, some people have covered this lanai area, and some people have gone further and pushed the wall out to here. And again, I think these are acceptable. This is the second floor. Well, on the first floor, they've done that. I think what's important on the interior is the flow, the outdoor-indoor relationships with all the major sliding doors. And also on the second floor, they have the sliding doors going out to the balconies. And I think these are major character-defining features of the place. Here you can see coming in, you have this wall, which is for the powder room, but it forms a foyer when you first come in. You don't just abruptly enter a living room. Here's the hallway that goes down one side. This will take you to your dining room and to the kitchen. As you can see, very open with the doors at the far end, the sliding doors. And the other way, you go through this door passageway, it's a flat arch, and you're into the living room. The living room, sliding doors, floor to ceiling, fixed windows above. And at the other end, the same thing, sliding doors and fixed windows above. The living room flows over towards the dining room. So it's a very open floor plan and very spacious. And again, the whole first floor essentially opens up. And here you can see the dining area again, opening out to a lanai and to a patio area. And open beam ceilings were in the dining area. Some houses still have that. The living room also had open beam, as did the first floor bedroom. And again, some of the units have that, some have not retained it. Here's an example of a unit where the mezzanine has been put in. But you can see, looking out to the front of the house, you still have your openness. And also on the second floor in the sitting room or office, you have openness as well. Here's another example of another house where that happened, with the mezzanine going in. Here's your powder room over here. Here's the flat arched opening going into the living room. I'm going to go through the 10 units very quickly. They're all pretty much the same. The only thing that's different are finishes. The first one I'm going to show you is the John McDermott residence. McDermott purchased the house in '71. He was part of Fawcett McDermott, very well-known advertising agency at the time. It was the largest advertising firm in Hawaii. I don't know if it still is or not, but they were doing much of HVB's advertising for tourism, and also they were supporting Democratic candidates, including John Byrne, Stan Inouye, and people like that. They were doing much of their advertising for them. And he purchased this unit here. You can see the carport that's on the side. And when they put the carports in, gates in the back of the carport open into the backyard. And this is the backyard of this unit. All the backyards are different. The property owners have control over what they can put here, although they do need approval. Much more spacious than most townhouses. And here you can see, looking back, this unit, the lanai has been enclosed. Here you can see the sunscreen on over it. Oh no, this one has not, excuse me. This is open. This is the end of the living room. And here you can see that, the two-story space of the living room. On the front side, there is a mezzanine here, which is used as a sitting room. And here's the sitting room space. This sitting room, some of the sitting rooms have sliding doors. This one retained the fixed windows. And here you can get a sense of that space of one bedroom back here, the other bedroom over here, the sitting room here. Koala Nye purchased a residence also. This residence unit 8 was originally owned by a man named Wilford Youth, who was an attorney, and he was actually the attorney for the contractor for the project, which was Hedrick Company. But essentially, he bought the unit and then he flipped it, selling it to Koala Nye, who was a resident of Menlo Park, California. And again, exterior very much intact. The front door. The rear, again, this one has the sunscreens over here, the balcony here. The original lanai, someone slipping into the dining room. And here you can get a good view of how the sunscreens are treated. This one has a very small backyard. It's actually behind, this hedge is right next to a 5 foot high retaining wall. And again, on the inside, the open beam ceilings in the living room. Also in the bedroom in this unit has the open beam ceilings. And upstairs, this is the rear bedroom looking out on the balcony. I think these are also original closet doors. About all the back bedrooms have a bank of closets on this side of the room. And I found these louvered ones with bifolds in several of the units, so I think they may be original. Harold and Lucille Hedrick. Harold Hedrick was one of the contractors. Him and his brother were the contracting firm for the project. And this is the unit he lived in. Here, his back lanai has a roof over it, although it's not enclosed. And again, this one adjoins the Nye residence. So again, a very small backyard. On the inside, here you're looking out towards the lanai. They have put in a tray ceiling. Again, the stairs are new, but I haven't found anyone that has the original straight run stair. This was an original. This is not. This is a refinished, but in this location were wet bars originally, and most of the houses units still retain a wet bar, although they have updated it. On the second floor, they have a large office sitting room. And because the lanai has been covered, they have a lanai on the second floor as well, balcony, a little larger balcony area. The Stueman residence, it's unit 37. This is one of the more intact units. I took Katie around to see several of the units yesterday. This is one of the ones we did go into. Again, exterior the same as every other one. The back has essentially a concrete patio area. There's a ravine down here which separates the property from La Pietra and I guess it's Noella Place. And again, two-story space. This, I think, also has the original teak floor. It's similar to what's in the Kahala Hilton, and it was a popular flooring in the 60s. So I think this is original. Also has the beam ceilings in the dining kitchen area. And this is the only one I've found so far. This was an alternative. Most of the houses had straight run. Some of them had spiral staircases, metal spiral. And this one still retains a metal spiral staircase. Here you can get a good view of that leading up. And then bedrooms again off both sides. And I just take this because I like this picture. This one, the downstairs bedroom, I think may have the original paneling. I'm not sure. It also has what I think is the original doorknob. I found this in two, maybe three of the units. So I think it's original. And so I suspect that the slat door is also original. And here you can see essentially the veneer panel. That's the wall. This room also keeps its open beam ceilings. The bathroom. The bathroom still has the original plastic grill light over the sink. Upstairs, this is the front bedroom. And again, this is original configuration with the bathroom off this side. You'll notice that projection on the front of the buildings. Right here. And essentially, that was originally a closet. And in this house, it's still retained as a closet with bifold doors. Some have modified it into a part of the bathroom. And here is the bathroom, which again, I think is fairly original. I don't know about the cabinets. Katie's thinking these cabinets could be from the period. I'm not positive. I'm not an expert on that. Anybody else that has ideas, be good to know. They have the plastic grills over the sink. And also this one still retains sinks in one area, then a pocket door leading into the toilet and shower area. Most of the people have knocked that out and made it one whole bathroom. Charles and Mary Page residence. He is a resident of San Francisco. I'm not sure. Charles Page is a fairly famous preservation architect firm in San Francisco. And I don't know if this is the Charles Page or not. I haven't been able to chase that down yet. The exterior. This one also has a carport on it. And on the back, they've made a wood deck out over their backyard area. Also, this one, the lanai has been enclosed. But again, you still have very strong openings with windows. Here you can see the enclosed lanai. They've kept sliding doors here, sliding doors on this side as well. Then the middle remains open. Then it has a mezzanine on the other side. Here you can see from the ground, still very open, very flowing. And here's the enclosed lanai. This house has fortune, has a very nice view of Diamond Head. And on the other side, it has the ocean as well. Here you can see some more of the carports. The Shen residence, again, this one actually has a carport between the two duplexes, and they have theirs on this side. Someone else has that side. Their back lanai has been covered, but it's still open. And it has a very nice, spacious backyard as well. The interior, you still have floor to ceiling, second floor fixed. Your flow going into the dining area. The stairway is treated in this manner. And again, you can see the wet bar. And this also has a mezzanine sitting room. The first floor bedroom, again, sliding windows and all of them are intact. This one also still has the open beam ceiling. And they have a view of Diamond Head from their bedroom balcony. The Hawthorne residence is next door to the Shen. And again, similar. I'm not sure if the association does this landscaping. I think they do because I've asked some of the owners, what's this plant in your yard? And they don't know. So I'm pretty sure this association maintains all these front yards as well as part of common area. This has the original lanai set up, the sunscreens, the balcony. Nice little designed patio, the backyard. And the interior again, dining area, all open. New stair, again, a wet bar. And the sitting room upstairs, almost floating with this glass balustrade. This house I find interesting. This is the master bedroom. And rather than, retain the second bedroom, they turned it into a walk-in closet. This is the Cavanaugh residence. John Cavanaugh was a member of Fawcett McDermott and later became president of that firm. And he was doing most of the HBB tourism advertising. And this is his unit right here. This is part of the duplex, but the recessed unit was his. Here you can get a better view of it in the shade of the trees. Again, they have a carport. Original front entry lanai, front doors. And this has the largest backyard of all of them, which runs all the way up here to this hedge. And actually beyond it is the swimming pool. But this is all done in a brick patio. Large plumeria tree. The lanai has been covered, but remains open. You can see from the lanai all the way through to the other end of the living room. Here you can see the living room better. It too, looking back towards the lanai and out the door. And this one also has a mezzanine sitting room. And here's the view of that. And the first floor bedroom still has its open beam ceiling. And here's the second floor bedroom looking out at the backyard. The Pritchard residence, Lawrence Pritchard came to Hawaii with World War II. He was in the Marines. And after the war, he moved to New York and was a businessman for 20 years in New York. In 1965, he moved back to Hawaii to be financial vice president of C. Brewer. And in 1970, he became president of C. Brewer. And then in 73, he quit Brewer and became the president of A&B and worked for A&B till 78. And this is his unit. This is on the that little side street, what I call side street, a little jog. And again, this has carports on the side, not just for this unit, but for several units. And there's a gate here that goes into the backyard of this unit, which again has been primarily paved, but as in a number of the other ones, retaining wall with lush tropical vegetation above. Again, you can see this is the dining room area. This lanai also has been enclosed. This one also has the original entry lanai materials. And on the interior, this is coming in powder room. The wall has been curved, but you enter into the living room space, which again has a mezzanine. And then here you can see where they pushed out the lanai. But again, very open, very airy. And here is that lanai that's been pushed out. Essentially, you just took the doors and moved them outward. Here's the original fixed windows above. This is a Bon Miedo. Originally, this unit was bought by a teacher in the DOE, but she lived up on Patey Drive. And 2 years after she purchased the property, she sold it to Bon Miedo, which was one of the earlier Japan-owned companies to work in Hawaii. It was incorporated in Hawaii in 1963, which was the year after Kenji Osano bought the Moana and the Princess Kaiolani Hotel. And they used this as a company house, as far as I can tell. It's this unit here, and again, a carport. In 1973, at the time they purchased the unit, it was one of only 50 Japanese businesses in Hawaii. Other ones included Daiei, Shirokiya, Fujifilm, Mitsubishi. This carport, I think this slat fence may be original. I've seen it in a couple other units, so I think it may be in the original treatment. Front door, again, they have the original paving on the lanai. And their back is, they face on Kapi'olani Park. So essentially their back is a patio. It looks like this. It was interesting when we went there, we turned around and found the groundskeeper taking a nap. But here's the view you get from your dining room out onto the park. So although you have a very, essentially a patio for a backyard, you have all of Kapi'olani Park to look out on. Here is that dining room. Again, you can see partial open beam kept. And again, the wet bar, new stairs. This one kept, again, the open beam on the living room ceiling on both ends, wide open to upstairs, their bathroom remains original. Here's the same bifold doors we saw in the other one. And again, separate bath toilet from the sink. And this sink also has the plastic grill over it. Here you go. So that's La Pietra townhouses, and those are the 10 units that are being proposed for registration today. They're significant, I think, in part for their associations with the development of townhouses in Hawaii. It is a very early townhouse development in Hawaii. There are several laws that were passed that made townhouses possible. The first one was in 1961 when the condominium law was passed. This was the first condominium law passed in the United States. Several states had condominiums, but there was no legal status for them. In Hawaii, it was done in response because co-ops, there was always a chance that the company, if it failed, everybody would be left hanging. Also, if you belong to a co-op, you're part of the company. If somebody in the co-op decides they're not paying their mortgage anymore, the rest of the people in the co-op are responsible for picking that up. And it's because it's company owned. So what condominiums did was instead made each individual apartment individually owned. And so each individual owner was therefore responsible for it. That was the first thing that was important for the townhouses. As a result of that, in 1962, Henry Kaiser out at Hawaii Kai, some of his first ones, he built what he called row houses. And this is the Terrace Lanai. And essentially, this is a four units with the garage in the front. And he had, I can't remember, there's four or six of these all along Kauai High Drive, street rather, excuse me. And they front on the ocean, or not the ocean, the pond. And as you can see, they've been messed up quite a bit over the years themselves. But as far as I know, this is the first attempt at what we consider, well, they were being called row houses and then townhouses, which would be used simultaneously. In 1963, the county passed a cluster housing ordinance, which allowed you to build a number of houses on one parcel of land, as long as you kept most of the land in open space. And again, Hawaii Kai, supposedly in the newspapers I found, they did the garden lanais, but I cannot find them. So I don't know if they're ever developed or not. But I can't find them on the ground anywhere now. In the following year, Tropicana Village in Wailai Kahala was built. And this is what I'd consider a typical townhouse development at the time, essentially a parking lot, which is how they used the open space for the cluster housing law, and then built the townhouses clustered around the parking lot. This is done by George Lee, and the architect, again, using hip gablet roofs. And they boasted the fact that you had no one living above or below you. Because essentially they had single story units on both ends and then a split level, two split level units in the middle. And so this is another early, this is 1963. This was developed. In 1966, Kaiser developed Kauhali Kai, which is another townhouse development, which is now called Marina Palms. Looks very nice from this side, fronting on the ocean, and you have your dock for your boat. And the other side is very similar to Tropicana Village, where you have your parking lot and the houses behind, and in this case, a wall separating your entry from the parking lot. The closest early condominium or townhouse that I could find that was even roughly equivalent to La Pietra was Coco Isle, which was also developed by Kaiser. And John Carl Warnicke designed this townhouse complex, which has 124 units. But essentially it follows like La Pietra, a circular drive. But rather than duplexes, there are four and sixplexes surrounding it with parking in the front. They also had a community center, which became a popular townhouse feature in the future. This was the moorings, which was done in, it was finished in 1970. John Tatum designed this, and again, on the water with your boats here. But again, parking became a central feature where essentially the townhouses are clustered around parking. And also the Village Green, which was also finished in 1970, which was done by John Rommel. Again, parking, this time they relegate it to the periphery. And then they do have walkways to get to your units. And that's the extent pretty much of townhouses that were built during the 1960s. In 1969, the county passed its comprehensive zoning code. And for the first time, townhouses were directly addressed and the requirements for townhouses were enumerated. La Pietra was done permitted before the passage of the CZC, because actually it probably could not, because one of the CZC requirements is that it has to be built in an apartment zoned area, which La Pietra was not. It was considered residential A. In addition to its associations with townhouse development, I think La Pietra is also important because of its associations with historic preservation. Bert Williams, in 1967, proposed to build the La Pietra townhouse development. This is where the project is today. Originally, the project was going to encompass all of this as well. The plan was for La Pietra to be demolished. And originally, he wanted 86 townhouses. La Pietra at that time was owned by Punahou School. The Dillinghams had willed it to them in 1964. They didn't know what to do with it. It was just sitting abandoned. And so when Williams approached them, they did give him an option on the property. And then Dillingham gave an option on their properties next door. So in total, there was 8 acres of land. He wanted to build 86 units. Punahou and La Pietra and the Dillinghams both convinced him to reduce that to 76 units. When news came out in the newspaper that he was planning this new high-end townhouse development, the Historic Buildings Task Force of the city came forward and into action. You have to remember 1967, that's the year the National Historic Preservation Act was passed. There was no Historic Preservation Office in Hawaii until 1969. There was no Historic Hawaii Foundation until 1974. So there was really no government agency overseeing preservation at this time. The Historic Buildings Task Force, I found a very nice introduction in the newspaper to it. It was actually founded at the end of 1965, and 66, the newspapers picked up on it. The task force was part of the Mayor's Action for Beautification Council. And the editorial in the Advertiser ran, "One of the quieter aspects of the city's beautification program involves preserving ugliness. The Historic Buildings Task Force is a part of the Mayor's Action for Beautification Council. Its job is to help determine which buildings on Oahu are worth saving as historically or architecturally significant. Not all such buildings are ugly, of course. Some are elegant old structures with a beauty and dignity that is ageless. But there are many buildings in Honolulu and on rural Oahu that deserve to be saved because they have cultural charm or retain the spirit of an era in Hawaii's history. Man will never build such structures again, and that in some cases is a reason for saving them." The task force was headed by Nancy Bannock. Nancy Bannock was the editor, the Hawaii editor for Sunset Magazine. She earlier had sat on the Chamber of Commerce's Beautification Committee, and in that role in 1963, she came out trying to get public support to save a number of Japanese temples and Chinese society halls in the area, which was later demolished to make, what is that area called? The one where Caesar Pelli's buildings are now. But it was for Hawaii Community Development, so essentially tore it down right on the Eva side of Nu'uanu Stream. But she tried to rally to get people to work to save some of those. The only one she was successful with was the Azuma Taisha Temple, which was moved to its present location on College Walk. But that was it. When she found out that La Pietra was going to be torn down, again, she started to do newspaper articles about it, talking about why it's significant. It's just a grand house. It was the most majestic house in Hawaii at the time. Pretty close, while Doris Duke's house was up already. But also Dillingham, the history of them, and entertained all visitors that came through, any politically important people, Roosevelt and people like this, all came to La Pietra. This is where they were entertained. And so she started to make a case. This is very historically important. We need to save this building. Very interesting. The students at Punahou School started a petition telling the directors of the school, this is not in keeping with the spirit of Punahou. Punahou should be preserving our past. And so this all started to come out in the papers. And Nancy Bannock in 66 earlier had said, all we have now is persuasion to save the buildings, which was true. And she tried to get the county to try and institute a board like the review board to look at historic properties. Obviously this never came to be, but with the passage of the federal law, the review board did come to be and could designate historic sites. The task force had 35 architecture students go around the island inventorying buildings. And then a volunteer group of historians and architects looked at the work that the students did. And they came up with a list of 60 buildings they thought should be saved. Eventually, this became the book Old Honolulu. The first entry in the book is La Pietra. So she's mounted essentially a public campaign. And eventually, they're planning... Williams was moving ahead. He had sold over 30 units for the project before it got built and was moving forward, getting ready. And he said, I'm going to tear down the La Pietra in the spring of 68. That date came and passed. And then in June of 1968, it was announced that the school for girls, La Pietra School for Girls, was formed and purchased the property. Williams released his options on the property and refunded the 30 buyers who had put down payments on the proposed townhouse he was going to build. And he scaled back the project from 76 units to half that size, to 38 units. Again, Jack Gilmore, tell me, I was talking to him. He said one of the reasons was that there was a question about water pressure. And I don't quite understand. It's not that high up the mountain, so I'm not sure what the water pressure issue was. But I think that Nancy Banik, in the role of public conscience, helped. And I think this is probably the first example of a developer altering their plans to address historic preservation needs. So I think in that regard, it's an important association with the property. And at the time, I think it was recognized as that way too, because Star Bulletin, in the obituary for Burt Williams, which was in 1978, so seven years after the project was finished, notes in his obituary that his townhouse proposal came at the beginning of a rapidly increasing environmental awareness by the general public. Williams could have proceeded under the existing zoning at that time, 1967, but decided to go for a master plan in keeping with the area. And so I think it was recognized very much at the time that this was public advocacy coming forward and changing what could have been a different development totally. Also in the newspaper, in his obituary, they also gave him credit for creating a distinctive Polynesian style design for his townhouses, which I think is very much true. The townhouses are a very good example of Hawaii modern architecture, with the use of the lava rock, with the use of the hip gablet roof, and just very understated, blending into the environment and the landscape. So I think it's actually a very good example of modern Hawaii style, modern architecture of the period. Williams, although he scaled back his project, there were people at that time, Save Diamond Head and other groups coming up that wanted no development on Diamond Head. And although he got all his approvals for his townhouse development at the end of 1968, the building department refused to give him a building permit. And eventually he had to take the building department to court. And in 1970, the courts ruled in his favor that yes, he has all his approvals, the permit must be issued. And so it wasn't until 1970 that construction started on the project, and then it was finished in 1971. In closing, I found this interesting quote. Nancy Banik also was trying, the original Central Union Church was at the corner of Baratania and Richard Street, where the state capitol now is, on that corner. And she knew it was a losing cause to try and save the whole building, but the dome was a rather incredible timber structure. And she wanted to try and find a new home for that, which was she was unsuccessful in doing. She mentions at that time, Hawaii needs just such good examples of its storied past to give continuity and a sense of place to its increasingly modern, all over the world-like scene. And I thought that pretty much applies to why we should look at La Pietra today, La Pietra townhouses, and that it is a good example of what was happening a little over 50 years ago, and that it is giving a strong sense of Hawaii as opposed to an all over the world appearance. So essentially the La Pietra townhouses multiple property nomination is being nominated, as well as the 10 dwelling units in the townhouse complex. And it's being nominated at the local level under criterion C as a very good example of a luxury townhouse. Yes, I didn't mention these townhouses in 1969-70 were selling for between $120,000 and $140,000. the properties I was showing you out in Hawaii Kai were selling for 40 or 50,000. Albeit they were leasehold, but still it does not account for the difference in price. So it is very much a luxury townhouse that was being built at that time. And I think it's being rendered in a modern Hawaii style in a very superb way. And also it's being registered under Criterion A for its associations with the development of townhouse complexes in Hawaii, and also for its associations with the historic preservation movement. With that, I thank you. If you have any questions, I'll stop sharing.
Thank you, Don. Any questions from the board for Don?
Yes, Bill.
First of all, I want to compliment you. I mean, the level of research is really terrific, and I think I really like hearing the context of how this was a compromise for preservation. And so that was really interesting. And I thought all of that was good. And I thought, you know, the quality of all the documentation was great, from the original drawings down to the character of each property. I've got an overall question, and this, of course, wouldn't affect listing on the local register, the Hawaii State Register, but I'm wondering, have we ever gotten a read from the National Register on what would constitute an appropriate approach to a cluster like this, as whether it's multiple property or whether it's a historic district? I remember when Carol Scholl came out once, and if you look at all the Park Service information, they'll say you identify the type of resource you have, right? So you identify a district as a district. So I've always had a little bit of a contention with the thematic district of Manoa, which is sort of like a voluntary string. It always struck me as that sort of the west side of Manoa Valley, the Heaviside, and the other over in Woodlawn area were intact historic districts. Do you have any feel from that, from the time you've dealt with the register people?
Well, the main, yeah, I did. So one of the reasons, like the Haolaulani place subdivision Hilo, yeah, that could have very easily been a district. The problem was a number of owners objected, which would have thrown it into contested case, number one. And so that's one way. Same thing, Manoa tried to make a district, but it failed, again, because of number of owners who are reticent to that idea.
I think they were too ambitious myself. They tried to do just one gigantic district for the
that's
whole.
That's true. Uh-huh. But I think even on like a smaller level, like College Hills, I think it would not have passed just because of owner concerns.
And so is that a peculiarity then of Hawaii? Because as you know, on the mainland, you've got a few people objecting. As long as over half don't object, it still gets listed. Not
yeah,
over
I think
half
that's
of
true.
Feet. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think here, just because of the Sunshine Law and the way everything is set up with contested cases here, where I think in the mainland, I think they're going to have to contest at the federal level rather than at the state level. Well, here, your actions can be contested into a contested case hearing and then actually be appealed to the court system. So the practicality of that becomes very onerous.
Well, I do know for tax purposes, we have to have individual listings. So
right.
Sense.
That also is another factor. So
only
I think
have one little tiny detail, and I kept trying to look. You said it was a gablet on hip roof. Are you sure? I was looking. It looks
hip
like
gable,
it's a gable, yeah. It looks like it's a hip on hip.
No, I think it's hip gablet. Wait, let me go back.
I know the ones that Hawaii Kai were definitely, I always followed the McAllister, and they like to call it gable on hip. And I know that locally we've tended to just refer to it as gablets on hip, but the gablets are the little gablets. So but the roof form is actually like a either a hip or a gable.
Oh, wait, that's not what I want.
No, that one has it.
Yeah.
But I was looking pretty carefully at one of the houses.
No, I think, well, this one's hard to read.
Yeah, it is. But there's one that's easier to read.
Yeah, here. No, it's. I think it's gablet.
Really? Because look on the left, far left, and the one on the far left. I don't know. It's
oh, you think there's a slant there?
To my mind, it looks like a hip on a hip on a hip.
I've never seen that before, but you might be right. Let me. I do have a close up of that one when I was showing the shingles.
It's just got a slope to it. That's all.
Instead of it's not a, okay. We won't call it double hip though.
No, it's called a hip on, according to McAllister and McAllister.
Oh, it is.
Call it a hip on hip.
That's fairly straight, Bill, but maybe.
I don't know. Look at the left side of that same roof.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're. No, I think that's fairly straight.
I think it slopes. I'm sorry, Don.
No? Maybe my eye is crooked, but I'll go with whatever one you want.
Like I said, it may be a completely anal thing, but I don't think it's a gablet because it doesn't have the venting or it isn't perfectly straight.
Yeah.
There's another closer view.
Yeah.
It's got a slope to it.
Okay, we'll change that to hip on hip. If it is, it's not a lot.
It's got a slope. So.
Okay, Bill.
Sorry.
I'll give you the Sharp Eye Award today.
I do like this rubber roof. That's what they put on the Pineapple Research Station, the John Young Museum.
Oh, they did? Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
They tried the Hardy Shake, and it was performing really badly, and then they did the rubber roof.
It's really convincing. I didn't know they changed that.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the people who aren't quite so into this, just what are you guys arguing about? It's whether that face is actually vertical or inclined. Is that what you're arguing about?
Yes.
Okay.
If it's inclined, it becomes a hip. If it's perfectly vertical, it's a gable.
Thanks for keeping us in line, Bill.
Sorry. I just think it's fascinating. So I'm taking... Assuming Marco Polo apartments were about 30,000 back in 1971. So I'm assuming if these were 100 something thousand, I'm guessing a unit there goes for about 1.8 now. Is that right?
I think higher. No, I think it appreciated more than that.
Wow. They're nice. I would move in.
Okay. Any other questions from the board? Any questions from the audience? Our meager audience today? Okay, thank you, Don. Anybody like to make a motion?
I'd like to make a motion to. They're only looking for a state listing, Don?
Yes.
So I think that would avoid some of the problems, but I would like to. I move that the Dillingham townhouse development, the 10 units that wish to be part of this multiple property nomination, be listed on the Hawaii Register of Historic Places.
Would you like to add as amended
under criterion A and C?
I was going to say, would you like to add as amended to change from change to the hip on hip?
Oh, okay. We can put that in. We'll add that too with small changes as suggested.
Thanks, Bill. Any second?
Seconded.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Okay, any further discussion? I did get to see these yesterday with Don, and it really was, it's quite a nice facility and, you know, very uniform with the different buildings, especially from the front side. They're all very much the same, and they've pretty well limited changes that people can make on their own to the interior, to the little back lanai areas. And we did go into several units and even inside. I mean, there's a few variations that people have done. Of course, everybody's changed their kitchen and their bathroom, but you still have the same feeling when you walk into the different units. So I think it's really quite a wonderful place. And it would be great if they can continue to keep it the same sort of uniformity on the outside, and, you know, honor the original design.
And Dawn, I just wanted to, you know, echo what Bill was saying. You know, great reading. I found the land tenure issues and the legislation really fascinating about how these things came about. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dawn.
Do you perceive other people joining the group?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I may be at least two more in August. So yeah, but essentially the board, many of the units being registered are members of the board right now. The board wants, okay, let's get it registered and then we'll spread it out to a larger group because they know that one or two people are very anti-government, but they think that a number of other people will, once they learn that this is available, will join as well. But I know two other people already have said they're interested.
Anti-government people tend to be anti-taxes people too.
Well, that's true. So maybe there's a chance.
Okay. Let's put this to a vote. All in favor of placing the La Pietra townhouses on the Hawaii Register. Looks like that's unanimous. Thank you. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Okay. Our next item up for bid, our next item is the Richards residence. I just want to see, would anybody like a 5-minute break before we move on, or are you guys okay to wait till after?
Anybody? I'm good.
Okay, great. Let's go ahead. I guess this is you again, Dawn, for the Richards residence.
Yes, let me find it. Uh-oh. Oh, here. Okay, then. Okay. The next property is the Herbert and Leilani Richards residence, which is located at 3760 Old Polly Road. It's actually not on the road. There's a little side street called Paris Lane, but the address is Polly Road. And so they sit on Paris Lane. The house was originally built in 1933, and then a major addition was made in 1936 to the house. I'll just say a little bit on that. Originally, Monty Richards, who was the great grandson of Amos Starr Cook, married Logan Shepherd. And he and Logan Shepherd Richards, his wife, started to build the house in 1933. It was a single story house. And I don't know what disease Mrs. Richards contracted, but she died at the Mayo Clinic in January of 1934, leaving Mr. Richards with two small sons. In the following year, in May 1935, he remarried. He remarried Leilani Rorig Brown, and who also had a son. And then at that point, they decided to expand the house. And so they put a major addition on it. I talked to Manny Richards, who is the son of Leilani by her previous marriage. And at the time, he was like 3 or 4 years old. But he says he remembers it being a one-story house, but he can't really tell. He said, no, it was a big addition put on it, and the second story was added. I have a hard time quite visualizing it all, but that's what he told me. And unfortunately, the newspapers showed very little light. As a matter of fact, the newspapers wouldn't even tell me the architect of the house. But I'm nominating the house at the local level under criterion C as a good example of a house built in Honolulu during the 1930s, inspired by the arts and crafts movement. This is the home. It sits on a very large parcel of land, very dramatic roof line with these intersecting hip roofs everywhere. And actually this one is a gable roof. I'm pretty sure I'll double check in a second, Bill. But shingle siding, post and pier foundation, corner entry with its own little out projecting roof, all of which are sort of typical, a chimney, fireplace at the far end. All of these are typical of arts and crafts homes. This house was done by William Morris in England in the 1880s. And I think you can see the roof line treatment, what this architect was trying to do as well, was drawing on this tradition. Here you can see the carport is tucked in on the other side of a hedge. And here's the backside of the house. This is a lanai which has been enclosed probably in the 50s, it looks like to me. But originally, the son remembered the house as being an L shape this way. And then this wing was added later. And as well as he's saying the second floor, but I'm trying to figure out where bedrooms would be if the second floor was added. Oh no, it's hip all the way. Here's the end with the chimney. Hoods over the windows on the first floor with figure four brackets, also very much arts and crafts. A little screen, wood screen, decorative screen over a bathroom window. Again, another. Also, the second floor projects out with these faux beam ends, and which is a very medieval image, motif. So it's trying to recall the Middle Ages, which is part of what arts and crafts was going back to, the whole idea of hand craftsmanship. And here's the entry, which again has a bracket here. Again, the hoods over the windows. Overhanging eaves with exposed rafter tails. Brick patio leading up to the entry. And then the entry is done in a very classical style. And again, Bill and I talked about this a little bit. And Bill was saying he was thinking of Lutyens, another British architect who did major things in India in the 1920s, who also started out as an arts and crafts architect. But then as his career went on, he started to incorporate classical elements into the arts and crafts and also started modern. And so you see, while you have a classical fan light up here, this is much more 30s modern kind of side light rather than multi-pane, which you would associate usually with a classical building. So you're starting to get this eclectic melding in arts and crafts sensibility. Here you can get a good view of the shingle treatment on the, so it's not just a straight, but they make it a more picturesque treatment. And also the patio has a herringbone pattern into the brick. Here's the entry from the inside. You can see they all, besides the side lights, they also put a on our window, which also would have been very 1930s as opposed to any other time. The front entry, the original door, six panel door, opens onto a foyer. This door here goes into the kitchen. It's a swinging door. Next to the door is a stairwell up to the second floor. And here's looking back at the door. Your kitchen is over here. Living room's to this side. And from the other direction, the living room. And here's the lanai that I pointed out on the back of the house. Pocket doors can close off the living room area. And again, the living room, very classical with its symmetry, fireplace, arts and crafts, hallmark of living rooms, built-in bookcases, arts and crafts, sliding windows, also casement windows on the other side. And also sort of classical, sort of art deco frame around the fireplace. Also very much art deco mirror above the fireplace. You can get a closer look at the detailing on that fireplace. And besides the entry from the hallway, you also have two exits that go out to the lanai. The lanai, I believe, was originally open, and I'm quite sure in the 50s, most likely, these large picture windows were put in to close the lanai. You can see the shingle wall here indicating that this was probably an exterior wall at one time. Here's the view from the other side. Looking this way, you have your dining room, then a family room beyond. All the house has all its original floors. Here's a set of French doors, more traditional, with the side lights of each of eight panes, which lead out to the side yard. The dining room off the lanai. Behind, these are two sets of sliding doors, louvered doors. I'm sorry, I forgot to take a picture. Behind these doors is a built-in buffet with all drawers down below and then shelving above. An interesting feature I like in this house, and again, very arts and crafts, is this little doorway here, which goes from, connects the kitchen to the butler's pantry. Rather the dining room to the butler's pantry. And it has a nice Gothic arch. At the far end of the dining room, the lanai is here. This little hallway goes down to a den or a study. And then there's an opening on this wall that leads into a family room. Here's the sliding door to the family room. The family room was added after 36. Because Manny remembers that being put on, but it was put on before World War II began. He called the family room the adult playroom. This hallway goes down to the study. There's a door right here, which you can see, which is actually opens on an elevator, which goes up to the second floor. Herbert Richards had a heart attack in 1952. Then the elevator was installed after that. It still works. Here is the study, built-in cabinets here. Again, very arts and crafts, woodwork. This is not an original lamp, but it's very much in keeping. 6-over-1 double hung windows on both walls, a bathroom off the study, as well as a closet. Bathroom has a single panel door. Throughout the house, there's single panel doors, all with glass knobs original. This still has its original scallop sink. And the wood screen gives some privacy to the bathroom with little casement windows opening on the inside. The family room, we go through this sliding door down a set of steps, and it's down below. These steps lead up to the kitchen. You have a wet bar over here. And next to the wet bar is a set of three double doors, which lead out originally to a backyard. The patio is new. It was put in the, I can't remember when, the 80s. But it's in keeping. It's a brick patio. It's banyan tree, nicely manicured. And then brick steps lead down to the lawn in the backyard. You can see another hood protecting the windows and the doorway over the side of the house. At the far end, another picture window. Here, I find very interesting is an indoor grill. Essentially, underneath here, where you can cook your meat, and you have a fire pit underneath and a vent above. As you can see, all fire brick lining the counter and the walls behind. They don't use it anymore. Here is the wet bar. Over on this side are closets with the push doors to open it. And then steps leading up. And right at the top of the steps is a small breakfast nook. These transoms are original. They had to replace these windows, but they replaced them with wood double hung windows. Then the kitchen has been totally remodeled, but it's been done in a sensitive manner. The windows are original. And at the far, here's the sink that we were just looking at with the windows. It takes an L, and here's the butler pantry. This is all original cabinetry, and they sort of tried to follow that when they were redoing the kitchen. And here you can see the other side, the same. Well, this is this side here, you can't see well. Now you can. And this goes out to the entry, the swinging door that leads to the kitchen. So the butler pantry connects the kitchen to the entry. Here is the Gothic arched passageway. There's a little storage under here. And I thought this was a very interesting use because you see this angle here. This is the stairway going to the second floor. And I thought that was an interesting use of under the stair. Usually it's just a closet. Instead, they made it into a passage. And again, this is all original cabinetry. And here you can see going in, seeing all the way through to the den. Another look at the cabinets, their dog. This door here goes out to the carport, which you see here. Again, another single panel door. Has a rather interesting lock and knob on it. They have lattice here to overlook the carport. Here you can see that screen. Here is a toilet sink, which also has a wood screen over it. And the carport, there's no door on it, although it does have sides. Back to the kitchen. Here's the butler pantry. If you go past the kitchen, there's a side door that goes outside. And this goes into the laundry room. And the laundry room still has its built-in ironing board. Okay, here's back out. Straight run of stairs goes up to the second floor. At the top of the stairs, it makes a turn. Then three more steps go up. I don't know what this gate is for. Manny, who lived in the house, Manning does not remember the gate. But when the present owners, the Scholls, bought the house in 74, the gate was here. So it's always been. So, but I'm not sure why, but Manning can definitely remember running down this hallway and screaming around and catching the banister, the newel post, and swinging around and going down the stairs. One of his better memories. There's a nice, interesting globe light above the landing at the top of the stairs. Here you can see that globe light. And here's the hallway, which accesses the bedrooms. This would be above the living room area. Three double hung windows for ventilation. Here's looking the other way. This is a closet. One bedroom wing here, another here, and another at the end. The first one, this bedroom, I think probably was the parents' bedroom. It's now being used as an office den area. And it leads down a hallway of its own. This goes out over the family room. And there is a dressing room off that hall. You can see closets here, a full-length floor-to-ceiling mirror for you to look at yourself, and then a vanity, all built in. From there, you can go down further. The elevator is here. This is a closet. And then you're into this large bedroom, which Manning remembers was his sister's room, Mary. And it's very large, very spacious, and very airy, all double hung windows. At the other end of the hall, this was two of the boys shared this bedroom. And then a doorway in that bedroom led into the other bedroom where the third brother lived. And again, three double hung windows there. This bedroom has a bath on this wall. Here you can see the door to the bath. Here's the door to the closet. Here's the door to the hall. And let's open that one. This leads into the bathroom, which connects to that hallway where we saw before, where you had the dressing room and then the daughter's bedroom at the end and the parents' bedroom up here. At the other end, when you came to the top of the stairs, rather than going through the gate this way, you could kept going straight to the area over the garage. And this was the servants' quarters. And there's two bedrooms at the end of that hall. Here's one, which and it has a little door that opens into the attic with a lot of storage space there. And here's the other, which also has a door to the attic. Both of these were used by the servants. And then they had a bathroom in between, toilet, shower. The sink is on this wall. And here you can see two awning windows above. And these are the two little dormer windows that are recessed. I thought it was a nice touch. The house is incredibly intact. Has all the original windows, original hardware, original doors. Only thing that's really been changed has been the kitchen, and that's been done in a sympathetic manner. The bathrooms have been changed also, but again, a secondary space. The patio is in the rear and is in keeping with the character of the house. The other changes, the elevators, the enclosing of the lanai, are all historic in their own right. And so we're nominating this to the Hawaii Register at the local level under Criterion C as a good example of a house built in Honolulu during the 30s, inspired by the arts and crafts movement. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. I do know if the owner would be interested in also being it, recommended for the National Register.
We can do that.
Okay. Any questions from the board for Don?
comment more. I want to compliment you again. I think it's a terrific house, really interesting. I guess, you know, you and I did talk about it a little ahead of time. It's so much like something Mark Potter would have done. And it's surprising that it isn't his. It certainly had an architect involved because the detailing and everything is really thought out. And that kind of federal style arch in the entry and things like that seems very sophisticated.
No, I thought so too. And I was like, there was in the newspapers, there was just one small thing in 1933 saying he was building a house. And then, for 1936, I was able to find, they mentioned the building permit in the newspaper, but they didn't mention an architect for it, which was very frustrating because, yes, I'm sure there was an architect involved with the house.
Did you check the tax records sometimes?
You know, oh, yes. No, it didn't mention.
Sometimes they do refer to it. Yeah,
they do. Mm-hmm. It did not. I did check that. And it's too old for a building permit. That the city has, I did check that.
Yeah, to be preserved.
Yeah.
I think all the bathroom fixtures are more recent, even your scallop sink. I don't think that's an original feature.
Okay, that's a nice sink.
It's nice. It fits okay, but I think it would have been probably simpler.
Okay.
That toilet is one I saw at Home Depot even now.
So. Okay, wow.
Okay, thanks, Don. Any questions from the audience for Don? Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
Sure, I move that we list the Richards residence on the Hawaii Register under criterion C and recommend it will be reviewed by the National Register Program as well.
Okay, any second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, any other discussion?
I just want to throw out, this is petty again, but I had a teacher who actually did a book on Lutyens, is how they pronounce it, just for future reference.
Okay. Lutyens, okay. The T is a C-H?
Oh, sorry.
Even though it's spelled Lutyens, he pronounced his name Lutyens.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a conflict of interest because Herbert Richards was my grandmother's first cousin. I mean, it's pretty far away, but I never knew Herbert or saw the house. But anyway, I think it's a great house. Thanks to your presentation.
If I may, Madam Chair,
Paul, yes.
The question, I mean, I think it's quite distant, but if you have a question in your mind about your ability to be unbiased in your evaluation, then you should recuse yourself if you feel you can make that judgment and not be influenced by that very distant relationship, then there's no need to do that.
You don't have any residual interest.
No. I've never been there, never seen it. I don't have any benefit from one way or the other. So,
yeah. Great. Thank you, Paul. Okay. Let's take a vote then, please. All in favor of placing the Richard residence on the Hawaii Register and recommending it to the National. It's like it was unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Okay, maybe now we can have a quick break before we move on to our next one, which will be Otsubo Monument Works. So back in, does anybody need more than 5 minutes? Okay, back in 5 minutes. Thanks. So even though we just passed 5 minutes, I'll give Bill Chapman maybe another minute. Okay, it's been 7 minutes, so maybe we'll just, oh, there's Bill. Perfect timing. Okay, we'll move forward with the next presentation, Otsubo Monument Works, as Laura Ruby. It's all yours, Laura.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I'd like to express my sadness at the passing of Bill Souza, former board member. He was such a nice and decent guy, always wanting to know more, always being concerned, always being very careful about what he said and very much cared about Hawaii. And I do miss his presence, even though he had left the board then, but he will be missed.
Thank you, Laura, for saying that. Thank you.
And also, this is quite a contrast to the very opulent places that Don has just described. This is a working place. And it is a site too. So I'm going to do a screen sharing now. Okay. And if you, okay, you're seeing only just my one screen, I hope. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay. The site, and this is what it's being nominated for, that Otsubo Monument Works. It is both a site, but it also includes a structure, the pavement structure, and artifacts or objects, two Hawaiian headstones, and located in Mo'ili'ili in Honolulu. Excuse me, I'm picking my cat off the table here. Let's see if I can. I think I'm going to have to scroll individually. Sorry. It's my kitty is insistent, right now. Hang on just a second. I'm going to put the kitty out. Sorry for the pause here. Okay. First of all, just to let you know, Mo'ili'ili, Honolulu, Hawaii, it's in the Waikiki. It's in the ili of Pa'akea or Kapa'akea. And the other mentioned site today is in the ili of Kuile. And so just to show you the naming of it is the Moku or Mo'u, meaning place or location, a site. And Ili'ili is a small native stones. And the small native stones are everywhere throughout a good portion of Mo'ili'ili. But in the location on Coolidge Street, it was largely karst. That is, it's the bare stripped surface of the solution caves and limestone beneath. So it had very thin soil on top of it. And I'm going to be reading several things here, so I hope you will go along with me. Most of the things come from the National Park Service Bulletin 16. I very much wanted to connect with my previous presentation that it really does connect with all of the measures of the National Park Service Bulletin. And in fact, it is your board is called the National Historic or Historic Places Review Board. So places, site, those are the larger pictures. So the Otsubo Monument Works is a part of Patterns of Our History. National Park Service Bulletin 16 says Patterns of Our History. excuse me, in particular, the site. And I've just highlighted some of the language that's continued to be used throughout. The site is significant at the local level under Criterion A and Criteria A history and events. And by the way, now criteria is used as both a singular and plural, just to let you know, although I grew up in a town that had a theater called Criterion. So, but criteria is used today as both singular and plural. So criteria, history and events under the history theme of an industry manufacturing facility associated with the early 20th century development of Mo'ili'ili town. It was a stone carving workshop site that had created permanent stone monuments to honor primarily EC first generation and Nisei second generation Japanese American ancestors, many of which are extant in the community. This site is eligible for the Hawaii and National Registers of Historic Places under Criteria A, History and Events. The National Park Service says, overarching goal states, the first is to state in chronological order in logical and regional context. The second is to reconstruct the past lifeways, including the ways that people made a living, the ways they used the landscape. The third is to achieve some understanding of how and why human societies have changed through time. So under Criteria A, Criteria A, history and events, is supported by analysis of the site, the Otsubo Monument Works business, the property itself, the property transfers, and the purchase by Sentaro Otsubo. The property continues to be owned by Otsubo Natsuyama family to this day. The property has historic integrity, though no historical remains can be seen on the site today. This setting constituted one poured-in-place concrete grid-like wall pavement structure, which incorporated adaptive reuse, even older, four white marble headstones, objects or artifacts. The two headstones were relocated to the nearby Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. The area of significance, which is also under industry, presents a body of thematically geographically and temporally linked information of early economic development of Mo'ili'ili town during the period of significance. That was the period of significance starts with the date at which Otsubo purchased the property, 1923, to his death in 1952. Sentaro Otsubo carved gravestones largely for the Ise and Ise generations of Japanese American families, and also monuments for the island of Oahu. I'll show a few later on. For foot safety, Otsubo created a pavement made from desanctified headstones so he could move his heavy stones and equipment more easily. Two of the significant inadvertent finds located in this pavement were stones for two notable Hawaiian individuals and one stone for the first Japanese seaman to die in Hawaii. And let's see, I'll just skip the period of significance. I just mentioned the justification is that the aspects of qualities of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association of the property are of primary importance in determining the integrity of this nomination. So I've expanded quite a bit on the aspect of integrity. And the National Register Bulletin 16 says a site is the location of a significant event, a prehistoric or historic occupation or activity, or a building or structure, and I underline, whether standing, ruined, or vanished, where the location itself possesses historic, cultural, or architectural, archaeological value, regardless of the value of any existing structure. Some of the examples here, and it serves to broaden the field of what a site is: habitation sites, funerary sites, rock shelters, village sites, hunting and fishing sites, ceremonial sites, petroglyphs, rock carvings, gardens, grounds, battlefields, ruins of historic buildings and structures, campsites, sites of treaty signings, trails, areas of land, shipwrecks, cemeteries, designed landscapes, and natural features such as springs and rock formations and land areas having cultural significance. And then I conclude with the Otsubo Monument Works are present today throughout Oahu. And a structure is a term used to distinguish from buildings, those functional constructions which made usually for purposes other than creating human shelter. Some examples will be bridges, tunnels, gold dredges, fire towers, canals, turbines, dams, power plants, corn cribs, silos, roadways, towers, windmills, grain elevators, kilns, mounds, cairns, palisade fortification, earthworks, railroad grade systems of roadways and paths, boats and ships, railroad locomotives and cars, telescopes, carousels, bandstands, gazebos, and aircraft. The Otsubo Monument Works pavement structure can also be included in this definition. And then objects, the term object is used to distinguish from buildings and structures, those constructions that are primarily artistic in nature or are relatively small in scale and simply constructed. Although it may be by nature or design movable, an object is associated with a specific setting or environment. Examples here are sculptures, monuments, boundary markers, statuary, and fountains. The monument works were created on site at the Otsubo Monument Works, but reside to this day in their permanent locations on Oahu. The two marble headstones artifacts now reside in the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. The bulletin defines a high degree of integrity. The integrity is the ability of a property to convey its historical associations or attributes. The evaluation of integrity is somewhat of a subjective judgment, but it must always be grounded in an understanding of a property's physical features and how they relate to its historical associations or attributes. The National Historic Landmarks Survey recognizes the same seven aspects or qualities of integrity as a national register: location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. Location, being the first one, is the place where the historic property was constructed or the place where the historic event occurred. The actual location of a historic property complemented by its setting is particularly important in recapturing the sense of historic events and persons. The Otsubo's property was both his residence and his workplace. He created his monuments on site, which on completion were transported to their permanent locations. Design is a combination of elements that create the historic form, plan, space, structure, scale, technology, ornamentation, and materials. The plot plan of the Otsubo Monument Works illustrates the placement of the residence and the workshop on the property to maximize both living and working accommodations. The residence, the large mauka yellow rectangle, and the workshop, the smaller, more makai yellow rectangle, indicates how important the arrangement of space was when both were on the same property. You might notice that the house, which is no longer extant, had to be moved because the widening at King Street had to take place. It was basically, it was a plantation style house with five panel doors, double hung windows, siding, post and pier, totan roof, and keeping with the Japanese tradition. It was a walk-in on ground level and about three or four steps up to the actual floor place itself. And in this site, I just showed what was originally the way the workshop was construction laid out. The next door neighbors, which were the Kumalais, where they're famous for their making of the ukuleles, and then some of the other aspects of the site itself. The setting is a physical environment of a historic property. It refers to the historic character of the place in which the property played its historic role. It involves how, not just where, the property is situated and its historical relationship to the surrounding features and open space. The physical features that constitute the historic setting of a historic property can be either natural or man-made and include such elements as topographic features, vegetation, simple man-made paths or fences, and the relationships between buildings and other features or open spaces. The Otsubo Monument Works was situated in the Ewa side of the growing Mo'ili'ili town, far enough from neighbors so as not to disturb them with his stone carving sounds, far enough away from the Kumalai residence and workshop also. The materials are the physical elements that were combined or deposited during a particular period of time and in a particular pattern or configuration to form a historic property. The Otsubo Monument Works was in close proximity to both the Mo'ili'ili Quarry, that's known for many of you people as the UH parking and athletic structures, and the growing Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. That's just not even, just a few blocks away. The quarry materials Otsubo obtained were fabricated into haka, or grave markers, for deceased individuals and then transported and installed at the cemetery. Reused headstones previously in other cemeteries, concrete and scrap lumber made up Otsubo's workspace. Workmanship as the physical evidence of the crafts of a particular culture or people during any given period in history. It is the evidence of artisans' labor and skill in constructing or altering a building, structure, object, or site. It may be expressed in vernacular methods of construction. The Otsubo Monument Works, and excuse me, and the pavement structure are evidence of skill in adapting workspace to accommodate the moving of heavy stones and equipment. Most impressively, his artistry, his carved stone monuments are permanently located in other Oahu locations, such as the Bamboo Ridge Ojiso at Halona Point and the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. Feeling is a property, is expression of the aesthetic or historic sense of a particular period of time. It results from the presence of physical features that taken together convey the property's historic character. At the Otsubo Monument Works, the family both lived and worked together. This was the case with so many Japanese American families in Mo'ili'ili and the other Hawaii communities so evident in the earlier years of the 20th century. An association that the other aspect of integrity is the direct link between an important historic event or person or a historic property. A property retains association if it is the place where the event or activity occurred and is sufficiently intact to convey that relationship to an observer. Like feeling, association requires the presence of physical features that convey a property's historic character. Otsubo created stone monuments at the Monument Works, which are permanently located throughout Oahu, including Bamboo Ridge, St. Andrew's Cathedral, and the University of Hawaii. The two recovered Hawaiian stones, as well as other monuments, are now at the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. Properties being considered must not only retain the essential physical features, but, and I underline this, archaeological properties are the exception of this. By nature, they may not require visible structures to convey their significance. This is interpreted to mean that Sentaro Otsubo, his property and work area, produced significant monuments on Oahu, and the recently discovered below ground pavement structure and artifacts were the means to produce these monuments. So just to give you the site, is setting, it's in the Kona district in the Waikiki Ahupua'a. And here you can see, can you see my arrow? I hope this is the location right in here. And this is a closer up view. This is the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. This is the Otsubo Monument Works. Right up here is Dole Street, is the University of Hawaii and the Alawai Canal. And this is the aerial view, Google Earth view of the site as it exists today. It is a site that actually extends out. They have some property ownership that extends out onto the wide sidewalk, but it's basically enclosed with a perimeter. And this is the site where the discoveries were made. And to give you a little geological background, this is the Mo'ili'ili flow that comes down from Pu'ukakea and Tantalus. And this is karst and fill and so forth. And this is the location right in here of the monument works. So it's on the karst. And in terms of historical location, it's in the Pa'ukakea area where it's karst. And you can see it's a place of ponds, streams, lots of water features. And There were no structures on the property prior to 1924. The environmental setting was very uneven with some soil and many areas of karst, that is the coral limestone and discontinuous solution caverns, the Pa'akea, protruding above the surface of the thin soil. You can see it here in the location where it's very, very rough going with what exists on the surface. Additionally, there were many keawe trees with root structures throughout the property. Otsubo cleared the trees and laid down pavement for his foot traffic safety and ease. This shows him building some of his sheds. And this is their non-existent house now with their entrance. This is really at the edge of the Kumalai property right here. But this is in celebration of Boys Day. And this is a bigger location. You can just see that the workshop area was set up in the what is today an open area. And the current structure built in 1963 is basically in this structure here. And here's the nature of Otsubo carved monuments is that they're placed in or carved in site specific locations. And if we have a moment of time afterwards, I'll show you a lot more that is put together in the document called Carved in Stone. This is Bamboo Ridge. And the story, of course, is that there were two previous Jizo figures that were there. One was unfortunately beheaded, and Mr. Otsubo took the body to his workshop area where it sat for many, many years, where Harriet Natsuyama and her two brothers played around it under the keawe trees. This is carved by Otsubo, and it's within the stone, so it's a relief carving, and that was intended to have no desecration. And this is a picture of him with his the fisherman that fished off of what we call Bamboo Ridge today, but Halona Point. And this is an example. This is carved for Senator Inouye's grandparents, located in the Mo'ili'ili Cemetery. And below is the hio, which has a very interesting history because it was carved specifically for the school, the Gakuen, at around Nu'uanu. And World War II came along and was quickly moved and buried. And then finally now it's in a temple area right off of King Street. It's right across the street from Central Union. And you can see it there today. Unfortunately, some people decided to add white to the calligraphy. Sentaro Otsubo's works were so quality that the shadows falling on the engraved surfaces or the relief surfaces were such that they always captured the calligraphy or the writing in very clear terms, but this was something that was done by this temple, apparently. And then this is the half of the founder's gate at UH, and it was they were both closer together and then moved apart when University Avenue was widened. And later on, I remember seeing this not maybe a decade ago or more. They were fixing the spalling on the other one, which was the one that was moved. And they unfortunately put a big bunch of globby paint over the beautiful engraving that was there. And this was done by Otsubo. Moving to the actual site of the discoveries, this was the first day in which Harriet Natsuyama said, "Hurry up, come quick. We found some grave sites." We didn't know what they were at the time, but this is all that was turned up. At this point, we put it back down in the ground until Susan Lebo, the head archaeologist, could come out and inspect and see if, in fact, it was what we were thinking it was, which was a pavement that was laid down of desanctified stones. And she said, yes, there were no burials there. So she gave me the authorization to go ahead and put it on the nomination. It's a very interesting historical find. And there's so many other things that are contingent on it. I might just go back and say that this is a normal occurrence when headstones or other stones were desanctified. They were often moved by salvage people, junk people, and then they were either resold or given away to other places. I remember in the 80s, seeing many, many headstones show up at the UH sculpture department. And this was kind of a shame because it was good for the students to be able to carve with them, but it was another thing that they had been left behind from somewhere else. I gave one example of one desanctified headstone, which is lying face down at my cemetery. So this is the plot plan, their plan of the actual excavation. The excavation was not very large in itself, and it shows the headstones of Ellen Kamakau and the headstone of Noah Kepoikai, and then the other headstone, Matsujiro Arakawa, the first sailor to be buried in Hawaii, and the other headstone was blank. Basically, it was unknown. The contractor would not allow me to excavate the other two that were only partially exposed. He thought he might compromise the slab. So we were able to take the two Hawaiian headstones out. And as they first came out, this is what you're seeing. The brown strips are from metal that was probably in the soil when Otsubo placed them face down. I do not believe that this is a break from the excavator. This might have also been a break from the excavator, a little unfortunate, but he didn't know what he was digging. This is the example of the one at Maimai. It's basically used as a stepping stone for the chapel that used to be there. So some of the stone characteristics and the stone types and pedestals and mountings to the pedestals. The pedestals are below. Sometimes there's two or three of them. Why? And why these particular two ones, why the stone pedestal attachments failed. They failed mainly because the pins that were attached at the bottom of the two ones were either pushed over or went over in the wind, or were, in the case of the Kepoikai, they were iron and they were rusted out, causing spalling and to break. They were way too short. The both of these headstones are way too heavy to have had such small pins. But in the days of the 1880s, people really probably didn't realize what was needed. And the type of characteristics of tympanum, that's the upper part of the headstone, and the types of engraving and relief carving are there. And the types of messages have changed over the years slightly, but they're there. And the date, the death date on the stones. And in this case, it's so important because her whole name, we did not find out until I researching documents, was Abigail Ellen. I'm forgetting the middle one, Holly Pony, and her nickname was Pony and Kamakau. She was the daughter of Samuel Kamakau, the eminent historian, and she was born at Kahopipa in Maui, and that's where their home was for many years. He, after leaving Lahaina Luna, became a teacher, a principal, a law enforcement officer in law system, and at some point they decided, maybe because his opportunities were better, he was continually writing historical documents, that as many people were moving to Oahu, that they moved and settled. Let's see, I'm going to go back here. They moved and settled in the area right in Lower Punch Bowl, which many of the more well-to-do Hawaiians settled in. This is just to show you a location of all the various cemeteries I investigated, trying to find out the exact location. I might say that Samuel Kamakau and his wife converted to Catholicism, I think, when they were in Maui. And that is the reason for these, all of the searches of all of these places with all of the many headstones that were marble. And as you know, that marble from the 1880s and even into the 1900s are eroded by weathering. And this is the compound where I'm 99% sure that this is where the two headstones were actually there. And this is borne out by the spacing that I did and the justification for where the pedestals, which probably were reused somewhere else, and then the headstones, which went on top of them. So again, you can see that how important it was for the location where they were born and the death of where at Kahehuna, where he died. Kepoi Kai was actually mostly based on Maui and Wailuku. And this says in memory of, and it's believed that this is a stone with no interment. It's rather in memory of because the family, Yukalin Aluli, who talked with me about it, thought that he had been buried in the sand dunes of Wailuku. And these, of course, would have been both body burials. And this is where they are in their restored places at the Mo'ili'ili Japanese Cemetery. The crown flowers are behind them. And this is in keeping with the many, many stone monuments that Otsubo carved also. And just to show you, this is the Keopop is spelled different ways. But it's basically in Kipahulu and their family. It's in the document, but the family was one of the land commission awards. And this is where they settled. Kamakau's wife was the direct descendant. I'm not even descendant, the direct with brother and sister of the land commission award. And this is Kahehuna where they settled. And you can still find the basics of where their place was, although the freeway has come through and many of the original disrupted homes are no longer there. And this is showing the way the land commission awards and the other properties were distributed in Kahehuna. And this is another Sudeikin map. And you can see also the location. Notice it was mainly that they would, most of the descendants would recognize Emma Street is where their properties were all in this area in here. And you can see Royal School. And so this is their full names, Noah, Kate Poikai, and Abigaila or Abigailia, either way they spell it. And Hakalele Pony, or Pony as she was called, Ellen Kamakau. And again, located at the Japanese, Mo'ili'ili, the Japanese cemetery. And then in conclusion, this is an American story and part of the historic, a part of the history of Hawaii and its immigration story and its entrepreneurial spirit based on its history and association with events that have made a significant contribution to the broad patterns of history, the history and culture of early 20th century industry in Mo'ili'ili town, the Otsubo monument works, the site, pavement structure, and artifacts and objects are significant at the local level for the Hawaii and National Registers under Criteria A. And if I can take just a moment, if I can find it, I will pull out the can you see this on your screen? Are you able to see this on your screen?
Yes, we can see it.
Okay. This is the carved in stone document that Harriet Natsuyama, I'm sorry, a granddaughter of Otsubo carved, put together. This is, Otsubo carved this himself, but after his death, then someone else had to place the his death date on it. These are located in the, I'm going to make this smaller. So just showing, I'm just going to show you that she can recognize his carvings because she'll run her hands over his carving surface. And there's a certain smoothing edge that's around the carving. And he was very careful about the shadows and the light as they fell on everything. And it's not one of these places you see where there's, unfortunately, people have added gold or something or white or even black at a later part. So I'll just tell you, one of these, the Manabi was recently destroyed in the car crash that came in. I mean, he was really the preeminent stone carver in Hawaii for his period of his activity. These are just the ones in the cemetery. But as I showed you before, there's the ones that are, they heal, the bamboo ridge, they, oops, no, I've lost my place here. Let's see. Okay, here we are. Are we back again? Stop. How do I make myself bigger again? Just a second. There we go. Okay. Whoops. Trying to share. I'm trying to share the last. Sorry.
We can see your conclusion slide.
The conclusion.
I can't.
Oh, we can see it.
Yeah, I wanted to go back one just to show you was I able to go back one?
Now we're seeing the two tombstones and the
mummy. Okay, that's what I wanted. Okay, just to let you know. Yeah. It's to me, it's a fascinating story because it's a site. It's a site of all of the production activity, the site of the workshop, and it's the then permanent sites of where things have been relocated to their site-specific locations. And I think that's it really makes it significant because it is the site that has a wonderful history of the coming of so many different aspects of Hawaii culture.
Are you done, Laura?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. Okay, anybody on the board have questions for Laura? Can you unshare your screen, please, Laura?
Stop sharing.
Okay. I have three quick questions, Laura. First, I want to compliment you. It is a wonderful and interesting story, and I think that gives a lot of texture and interest to the whole thing. My three questions are, why did you not tick criterion D as archaeology? Because that's the one I would have said is the significance.
Early on, it was another person no longer on the board raised that question. And it really is not as significantly archaeology as it is the history and culture and events. And while it is something that he did do, and he did make that concrete structure, and he did take the repurposed headstones and make his surface for walking on and transporting the stones. It is just one aspect of this. So much of what it is. I mean, I could. I just felt that it wasn't as large a purpose as the history and events. That's why it's only for history and events.
But in terms of the site itself, that seems to be the significance for the actual site.
Yeah.
There's no way to, I mean, the other is, in a sense, reinforces the interest of his story, like the tombstones in the Mo'ili'ili Cemetery, but they aren't directly part of the site. I think, Matt, you might want to weigh in on that at some point. It seems to me a historic archaeological site is what we'd be nominating.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've given those comments to Laura previously.
The second question is, when you keep talking about desanctified stones, I'm assuming you mean informally desanctified by Mr. Tsubo himself. They didn't bring in a minister or a priest to go through some sort of desanctifying process like they would for a church, did they?
I believe that what happened is when these stones fell over or toppled, and many, like many, many other cases, like I said, all of the ones I saw in the 1980s that were removed from their original grave sites were desanctified by a priest or at some form before they ever got to the salvage people which then transported them to, in the case of Mr. Otsubo or the case of University Sculpture Department.
You don't know for sure whether these particular stones on site were desanctified, right?
No, the Mai headstone was turned face down. We turned it over. It's a actual one of the military forms of grave markers, and it was turned down. And I don't know if that would have been, it would have come from some military setting, perhaps, maybe not. It wasn't from the Mai cemetery, so it was coming from somewhere else, yet it was on cemetery grounds. Desanctified, it means that it's no longer part of the sanctified church or temple site.
It's just, I guess, because they use the term desanctifying for churches and chapels, and it has quite a technical meaning. They actually have to have a ceremony and things. I would just think maybe that's stating it too strongly. And maybe so,
would you want removed?
Removed. And there's a lot of reasons they might have, maybe because of deterioration, they wanted to build a new one or something like that. It's hard to know.
These particularly, both of them in the nomination, both of them were so compromised with their pins. The pins on Cape Waikai were eroded because they were iron, and they spalled out and broke the bottom part of the tombstone, and the Kamakau one was pushed over, and a little bit of breakout from the pins there. So they were not able to be stood up again, according to somebody.
Those answer my questions. Thank you.
Any other questions from the board for Laura?
Hey, Laura, this is Matt. I want to just thank you for all your hard work working on this nomination, which is this the third or fourth time you've brought it before the board?
I don't know. Is it second or third? I don't remember, whichever. Yeah.
It's at least the third that I can remember, maybe the fourth. I've gone through your document. I made some revisions and some comments that I was happy to supply you with. When we last spoke about this matter, you reached out to me and asked for my input on what should be done to the nomination after the second or third time that we turned it down. My recommendation to you at that time was to contact SHPD Architecture and Archaeology Branch, explain to them what you wanted to do, and get their input. Did you do that?
At the outset of this, Susan Lebo, who came to the site and investigated, when she presented her two brothers' shipwreck, which is underwater and not visible, but it does have the remnants of a ship structure, and it has many artifacts scattered throughout. That is the standard that I was using as the way in which things that had been underground that were not seen visible anymore. Perhaps there were some artifacts removed from the shipwrecks, I don't know. But it has a similar idea of the fact that it was below surface.
Again, can I interrupt real quickly? I have Susan here that would like to share some comments.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Okay, so this is echoing. Sorry about that. So this is Susan Lebo from SHPD. I didn't do the two brothers. The two brothers nomination was done by another party. It was not done by SHPD or by myself. The difference between this site and the two brothers is that the two brothers is an underwater archaeological site in which the ship remnants are still there, as well as the archaeological or cultural materials associated with that vessel. And they had a complete site in terms of the entirety of the vessel location and the actual shipwreck. Yes, I visited current Otsubo site. Only a very small portion of the property was actually investigated. I think it's probably less than 5 feet by 10 feet. So whether or not the entirety of the Otsubu Monument workshop and, you know, any of its associated monument debris piles where they would have discarded stones that were no longer usable or monuments that were damaged and they weren't going to reuse. None of that was exposed. So we do know from what has been exposed that is that there's at least some buried foundation, concrete foundation. And then there is this brief or short walkway. So that is the context of the archaeological component that has been identified and what the original site may have looked like and its overall spatial extent and whether or not there are more structural features related. I can't answer that. But that I know that that was one of the questions that had been raised by the review board previously and that Matt had reached out to get a better understanding about, you know, what do we know about the site?
Yeah, so, short of jackhammering up the entire slab that covers the workplace surface, we weren't able to do anything further than this.
Yeah, and that's correct. And so we don't know if the rest of it's there and what its condition is. We just know this one little section. And then in terms of the stones, yes, the stones were facing down. In terms of the writing, whether the stones were something Mr. Otsubu acquired from, you know, they had formerly been in a cemetery and were no longer in use and were acquired that way, or they were acquired prior to ever being used in terms of maybe they were damaged or were discarded for another reason before ever being placed in a cemetery. We don't know that.
No. Both wearing on the pins suggests that they were in place for a long period of time before they fell victim to the their own inadequacy of being supported by the pins.
Right. But we don't know where they may have been.
Well, I did do the investigation of all the cemeteries on Oahu that had 1800s, early 1900s marble primarily are stone monuments, and this was the one that is the Kamakau compound in the Roman Catholic Cemetery on King Street. And it fits the footprint of the pedestal stone that's still there, where the second pedestal stone is missing, which would have supported these large headstones.
Did you identify the grave locations within the cemetery based on so that you've documented that these two individuals were in that cemetery?
Oh, I don't have any proof that they were in the cemetery, but in the compound, the size of the pedestals and sort of doing a subsurface investigation of Ellen Kamakau to find the Evie, the remaining bones that would be in there, should they be in there. There's no way of knowing precisely that it was, and you're not going to do an investigation of the bones as to the disposition of them, I don't think. And so it was with really, like I said, 99% certainty that this is where they were.
Susan and Matt, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but one of the things under criterion D is the potential for future knowledge and whether Laura had the opportunity to take off more stones or not, the potential still exists to learn more about this site. That's why I think actually that would be the strongest criterion.
I agree. Again, that's information we've given to Laura on several occasions, that D would be a better criterion to try to list this on the register under.
Well, do you want me to change it and include D? I thought that because the site, which was about 17 feet by 7 feet, that was all that was exposed. I thought that that was a small section to be considered for archaeological section D, but I can easily add it, but I won't have anything further to add because I couldn't even pull out the other two stones. The original, and I mean original one of Arakawa's stone, which was broken and damaged, and the blank stone. And there might have been others if I could have rooted around in there, but the contractor would not allow me to do it, would compromise the slab, he said.
But it seems you have a map that indicates where the whole of the stone working site was. That would seem to be the logical boundaries for the archaeological site. One thing, as Susan and Matt know well, archaeological sites are sometimes not preserved. They're sometimes excavated. So it doesn't have the same expectation of preservation necessarily that a house site might have.
Yeah, we've been talking about this a great deal, and I have prepared sort of an argument by analogy. I'm happy to give that if I can get the approval of the board to maybe put this to bed. Is everybody okay with listening to me for a few minutes while I go through this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Again, I like to just make an argument by analogy, basically. If you could cast yourself back to the late 1800s in eastern South Dakota, my grandfather was born then. Odin Thompson, Norwegian family, spoke Norwegian at home, first generation immigrant. He grew up in a farming community. When he got older, he realized he didn't want to be part of farming, didn't want to be a farmer. He went off to Milwaukee and became a pharmacist. He got out of school in Milwaukee and he moved out west, which at the time was just moving across the state into western South Dakota, where he invested and became part owner of a pharmacy in a small town that was brand new, 1910 founded, 600 people. And Odin Thompson, my grandfather, became a pillar of the community, very similar to Otsubo. He was part of the expansion of the West, the movement of cattle herding into this prairie area. He was decorated in World War I, where he worked in the field hospitals as part of the leadership of this small town. He was big in Chamber of Commerce. He raised money for the baseball teams and for education, just like Otsubo did. He was the only person in the community who had any medical training as the pharmacist. He wasn't a doctor, but he did have to deliver the occasional baby, and he had to doctor the people's livestock as well as the older folks, give them their drugs. So again, a very integral part of the community. He passed away in 1971. His son, who was another mover and shaker in South Dakota, who actually eventually ran for governor, he got a grant from the federal government. And in 1975, they tore down the drugstore, this Thompson Drug, which was a big component of the community. It's the place where my grandfather used to pace back and forth and raise his money. It was the center of all his good works. But they tore it down in 1975, along with the diner and the bar and the post office that were all part of this little strip mall. And they built up a new strip mall that had the new drugstore and the new diner and the new post office and the new bar. Not a pretty building by any means. The older building was really pretty and had awnings and was right out of the 1930s, but that was gone. And I happened to be in South Dakota in 1975 when they tore it down, and there's not much going on there. So I watched them demolish it. So I can testify that probably that old cement slab where my grandfather used to pace back and forth was there. And it's probably buried under the new concrete slab. So, you know, the question is, if some archaeologists someday dig up through the new slab and find the old slab of the drugstore that my grandfather owned, would that be a significant historic property for the National Register or the State Register? And my argument is no. It's just a concrete slab. It doesn't really convey its significance. It doesn't have really much integrity. So to further the analogy, maybe at some point they stuck some medicine jars from my grandfather's pharmacy industry in the boards. It would be similar to these headstones, which are put in there.
The headstones are there just as happenstance. They're used as pavement. They're what's created. All the background information that you've created about the headstones, it's really just happenstance. These people passed away and their headstones were erected long before Itsubu was there. And they're really just building materials. So, you know, my contention with this is you just don't really have the significance and integrity for this Otsubo monument works to be significant criterion A. You could potentially make an argument that's significant criterion D as an archaeological site, but that's not what you're doing here. I've got a list of other things that, you know, specific instances where I have disagreements with the nomination. I can go through those, but I just, you know, wanted to pause here and just say that that's how I'm seeing this. Maybe that will help convey to you why I keep voting for this to not be put on the National Register or the State Register. Any questions about that at this point?
Well, if
I could throw in something, I mean, theoretically, I suppose, Matt, I suppose that you could do a study of mason yards, and this would reveal information about how masons in the early 20th century operated, and there may be revealed information, just as if you excavated a 17th century blacksmith shop or something. I suppose you could make that argument. Am I right?
Yeah, no, I'm. That's what I'm saying. You know, it could be under criterion D, you could make that argument, but that's not what's being made with this nomination.
Well, I had at the initial outset of when I presented this, it did not seem to be the strongest argument. And that's why I went for just history and events as being pivotal and the main criteria.
You know, as we go through the document.
I could add on. I could change it if that would be requested.
Laura, my concern is that what exists there doesn't convey that story well.
Yeah.
But you don't have to see something to have it have historical significance.
Well, maybe to some degree, but I think you do. I remember, I'm going to give another analogy. I remember I went to St. Kitts one time on a tour for the Smithsonian, and we got ahead of the people ahead of time, asked them to point out some historic buildings, and the poor woman who put on our tour showed us the locations of former historic buildings. And she said, this used to be the government house. It's no longer there. This used to be the wharf. It's no longer there. And so in a way, that wasn't really telling the story of any of these buildings, though you might have been able to make an argument that the site itself, had it not been redeveloped, would provide an opportunity for understanding about an 18th century government house, maybe. But that would be under criterion D, not under criterion A. Because A isn't conveyed by the site.
I would tend to agree with Bill too, that the site isn't currently, doesn't have those aspects of integrity to be able to convey what's there.
But it does say that in the national a bulletin that you do not have to have the specifics to have something that is a historical place or events. And it does have, and because it's a different kind of industry workshop, which was designed to then immediately take those monuments and place them in specific sites, or in the case of UH Founders Gate, to carve it directly there, or in the case of St. Andrews, to carve it directly there. Those are the things that it's situated, it's sited in its specific places that are outside of the workshop. The workshop was a beginning place for everything to start, and it needed that structure and pavement to make it possible.
I think maybe what the Park Service would be referring to possibly would be the site of Daniel Webster's speech in southern Vermont could be a site with nothing still there, or the site of a battle in which there's no necessarily any archaeological evidence. Those are the kind of sites I think they're talking about. But your site is kind of significant because it was used as a stone yard, and yet there isn't enough to convey the whole story of that for criterion A. I don't know if that doesn't have that event quality that the speech or the or the battlefield might have.
And it's known that the product that they're creating would no longer be in the workshop. It's out in the cemetery, but there also isn't, at least from what we can so far see, evidence of that workshop. There's no tools, there's no things that sort of present the actual workshop to us to see what happened there, as far as we can see.
Only archaeologically does that potential exist, I suppose.
I imagine all of the workshop tools and everything were sold to the Sassano family, who then carried on the workshop tradition, but at a different site.
In terms of, you know, his importance as an artisan and a community leader, it just seems like if you want to make that argument, the physical remains, the things you can interpret, the things that have integrity, are the actual monuments themselves, which are out in the community. It shows how successful he was, how people reached out and used his services, because these monuments are throughout the various cemeteries. That's a more tangible thing than this small remnant of an industrial site.
Well, how does one go about doing a nomination for all of the monument, or a portion of the monuments that have significance in Hawaiian history? And they are situated in permanent spots.
Yeah, that I don't know.
I mean, you have probably Kamehameha statue or something like that would be probably an individual statue was probably could be put on the register for state or national, but it's
the it'd be listed as an object, Laura. It'd be listed as an object. Okay. I don't know whether you could do a multiple property object nomination or not. Alan, I don't know if you know.
Well, that's why this is a large combination of things that is all coming under what I focused as the one site. Yeah. But meaning having its sitedness in other permanent locations.
So perhaps you need to have further discussion either with SHPD or the National Park Service to kind of determine whether that's possible or what would be the best method to nominate that. Or look at nominating this for criteria D.
So this is Susan. Under criterion D, the question is there enough of the site there to convey that the different criteria of integrity and to convey the significance of the what the function was of this site and its relationship to Mr. Otsubu? So the question is, again, I mean, is there the monument field in terms of where he had his stones that he was going to use to make the monuments out of, or his discard pile from the monument making? Do we have enough there to convey what we know was the size, the dimensions, the of the factory itself? Do we know, where all the work areas are that were associated? Are they represented in the archaeological record? And so those are the kinds of questions that, in a nomination under criterion D, people are going to be looking at those different aspects of integrity to say, do we have those aspects of integrity? And if so, what questions important to history can be answered from looking at the archaeological remains that are present at this site? We're not going to answer the question that Mr. Otsubu had a site here, because we can answer that without the archaeological remains. So what will the archaeological remains tell us about Mr. Otsubu and how he did his monument making, and whether that was same or different from any other monument maker in the Mo'ili'ili area of the same time period? And can we look at his site and physically see something or say something about his manufacturing processes, where he got his stones, whatever? So I think those are the kinds of things that, if the nomination is redone as under D, those are the kinds of things that would need to be answered.
How did he organize the stone yard? Is there an indication of where did he store stones? Where was the wear patterns and things like that? What was the nature of the business? I think those would be questions that might be interesting and valid because we don't know much about early 20th century stone yards. But I think you'd have to make that case. I'm thinking, as Susan said.
I think the photographs that I included show a whole pile of stones that have been selected by Otsubo, ready to go. And then I showed the inside of the wood, the work shed, which has the very, very heavy work table with one stone on it. And I showed the anvil and those kinds of things. Those are all of the ways in which he worked. He would probably work on a stone inside the wood, the covered workplace. And then at the point where it's completed, then it would move out and it would be transported to its location. So we had reserve ones that are in the picture with the well and everything. There's a picture of the stones actually there. And although we don't have the picture of the Jizo head that sat, the Jizo body that sat there for decades, it was right there on the site also. We
but
have
you're
the-
trying
have,
to make it, but Laura, you're trying to make a case for its continuing value for providing information, not simply saying we already know all that, because that actually contradicts the idea that it has value under criterion D if you're arguing that there we know it already, so there's nothing else to look into or say. Then you don't want to use archaeology, but I don't see that you can use anything else.
No, I'm not sure. It's would it... If Susan Lebo is still on the line, does the amount of discovery in an archaeological find have to be extensive, or does it can it be as small as that 17 by 7 excavation that was done under this through the slab?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, please.
You know, it doesn't matter about the size of, you know, the extensiveness of it. The question is whether or not what criterion D says is, has the potential to yield information important in history and prehistory. So you have to be able to make an argument that this site, number one, has sufficient integrity to yield information, and then two, that the information is potentially significant. And that's, you know, that's the hurdle you have to get over. You can answer both those questions positively, sometimes for very small sites, but sometimes for very large and extensive sites, the answer is no. So, I mean, it isn't just a matter of the extensiveness. It's the question of what questions can you answer? Is the information that you want to answer potentially there? And then are those questions significant? So.
I think the issue of integrity for an archaeological site is quite different from what we use as integrity for a building. You're sort of thinking more about what's there, whether it's intact, but the integrity of the site is how much of the archaeological site is still in place that would allow a researcher to answer questions about that site.
Well,
in terms of the significance and the integrity, you know, you talk about the setting and feeling and association. You say this all still has that, but you're arguing there that, you know, the setting and the feeling and association was based on its location among all these other Japanese immigrants. And you're describing the situation as it was back in the 1940s. It's not that now. It doesn't have those integrity of setting and feeling and association right now. It's just a change that needs to be made in the document itself.
Well, that's why the period of significance ends with his death in 1953.
Right. But you're describing the setting, feeling, and association now, not 1953.
I'm not sure about that. I believe I was describing Mo'ili'ili in the 1920s, 30s, 40s.
Right. No, but you have to, that has to convey it now, as Matt's saying. I mean, every site conveys that in its own time, of course, but now it doesn't convey that. You basically got the St. Louis High School Club and the First Hawaiian Bank, and the setting around it has changed quite a lot. I think it doesn't convey that, and there's not enough that you're seeing to convey what you're arguing for.
but the permanent locations of the monuments are still intact. I do not believe, except for the moving of the Hill monument, they've all been basically intact and not moved at all since Otsubo carved them and placed them there.
But those monuments are no longer located within the site that you're nominating. We're talking about the integrity of the site itself.
Yeah, the two Hawaiian headstones, but all of the other ones that he carved are all in situ, except for the war moving of the Hio.
But those don't relate directly to the site.
They were carved
indirectly to the site, but not directly. They aren't on the site.
No, they were carved on the site by Otsubo over a period of years or decades.
I understand that, Laura, but they're not associated directly, physically with the site right now.
So Laura, perhaps you can take the comments and information that Matt is offering and maybe work a little more with SHPD to sort of refine the statements of integrity and what criteria this should be nominated under.
Okay. Matt, would you be willing to send me those notations that you had?
Absolutely. Again, I applaud your tenacity, your stick-to-itiveness, but I really think, you know, this is now the third or fourth time that we've discussed this, and you really need to speak to the architecture branch and the archaeology branch and have them review what you're preparing before you bring it back to us. That I would really like to see that happen.
Well, I do believe that they've reviewed it again, because what I added was pretty extensive from the last time that I did present.
I know Susan Lebo did not review it for archaeology. Did the architect branch review it?
I sent it to SHPD. I'm not sure where all it was distributed to.
Okay.
If I may, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
To be clear, I think I have said this to the board in the past. Because the board has expressed such a strong opposition to SHPD providing any opinion about eligibility, in this process, we do not do substantive reviews. We simply look to see if all of the parts are there and they're all in the right place. I it's up to you folks if you want to revisit that discussion, but I mean, I think the expression was so strong in the past that, you know, I don't know that there's a reason to revisit that.
I was on the board when that happened, I think, and I remember it was just, I think what happened is we had several professional staff before who we have now made very strong recommendations as if it were a fait accompli that this was eligible. I think that was the objection way back in the day. That was quite a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, this is off topic for Professor Ruby's nomination, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I think we can have that discussion another time if the board wants to have it. I think that, you know, I mean, and in fact, we will have to have it because we were informed yesterday by the Attorney General's office that the way we prepare the agendas is not consistent with the Sunshine Law. We do need, in fact, to tell people on the agenda what the proposed action is. Their feeling is that it doesn't do that now, but as I say, I think that's off topic for Professor Ruby's nomination. I mean, if, you know, I believe Susan has talked with Professor Ruby about this. I wouldn't say how extensively because, I wasn't a participant in that discussion, but I mean, we can certainly talk again. But I do think I have to be, it would be dishonest for me to say that at this point I've seen anything that suggests to me that it is eligible under D. And I won't speak for Susan on that, but anyway. So it's a matter of what you want us to do with this nomination, if you want Laura Ruby to bring it to us and try to work our way through it to strengthen it, we can certainly do that.
I'd like to see if we have a motion for anybody in our group. to place it on the register or to defer it.
I'll move that it be deferred, that and that Laura be it recommend that she consider applying under criterion D for archaeology, and then determine whether there are questions that could be answered archaeologically that sometimes might even require some archaeology to make that determination. But I don't, and that would be something she could discuss with Susan. The other recommendation would be that if she wants to just look at the existing monuments, whether there's any precedent for a sort of multiple property objects listing, that would be something that she could look into. But I feel strongly that the site does not meet the criteria does not meet criterion A or B as it exists today.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, any second to the motion to defer?
Second.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Any further discussion?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think it's a real important story, and the fact that there's something there, you know, I'd never heard of the whole issue of the, you know, the first generation Japanese businesses. And, you know, I think a lot of the first generation traces were not preserved because they were so temporary and they didn't have the money to build significant things. But I mean, I do think it's an important story, and I don't know the technical details in the, you know, for a historic status. So if there is a way to put interpretive stuff or, you know, to keep the story alive, I'd like to see that happen somehow. So anyway, I'd maybe defer, maybe looking into it even further. I don't know.
The owner has agreed to put up a plaque or informational signage. If that would satisfy it. Sometimes there's mitigation efforts that are done in that particular way.
I mean, it kind of fulfills the intention of having a historic structure, and whether it meets the technicalities, you know, it's over my head personally. So I just would like to see the story preserved somehow. Thank you,
Paul. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, who would like to vote, please, in favor of deferring this nomination? Okay, looks like that is unanimous. Okay, thank you, Laura.
Okay, and I'll reach out to Susan Lebo, and I'll reach out to, if Paul Lesignan will respond, I'll reach out to him also, the National Park Service.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Okay, next item on our agenda is the meeting dates. Of course, our next meeting is tomorrow, and following that is May 20th, August 26th, and November 18th. Dr. Downer, have you heard anything about May 20th possibly being in person?
So what we are hearing from the governor is that he intends to allow the emergency proclamation to expire on the 25th. After the, you know, starting on the 26th, we will have to return to face-to-face meetings. The law allows mixed meetings, but the technology is out of our reach. You know, because the meeting has to occur at a physical location. You know, that's what the law says. So, you know, if you've been following the legislature, they have the technology, but their technology far outstrips what's available to us. So it will have to be, unless something changes in the next week, it will be the next and subsequent meetings will all be face-to-face.
On the other hand, Alan, the COVID numbers are spiking in Europe and England. So who knows what we're going to be in May. So
And I mean, I won't pretend that I am engaged at this at the cabinet level, so I don't know what actually discussions go on there, but I'm reasonably sure that the governor is basing his decisions on what he hears from the state epidemiologist. But yes, you're right. I mean, on the other hand, the numbers here continue to drop. Maybe we will be the exception. But yeah, the numbers elsewhere are pretty scary.
Okay, so to be determined.
Yeah.
Okay, and then also we have our list of submitted nominations for the May 20th meeting. You can see in the agenda. Any other discussion or questions?
I don't, Miss Kitty, as chair, I'd like to just, I was at a meeting last night of another organization and someone approached me about the Kaiser estate. There were two people that lived in the vicinity and they complained that there was an access sign, but once you got in there, you actually couldn't see anything within the, and I told them that's about enforcement. But I did say I would convey this to my group. We're not involved in enforcement. And I think at some point, Alan, I think we need to discuss. I mean, once we start listing apartments and townhouses, at some point we're going to hit a point where it's just taking too much out of real estate taxes and revenue. I happen to feel we're very generous. I think even something like half price or something would be more reasonable. But my feeling in the community is that people are beginning to see things like, oh, why are these rich people getting this good deal?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, bearing in mind that that's a county issue. I mean, in the county periodically revisits it. So far, it has survived intact.
Right. But we're part of the process. That's all.
So. Yeah, but I agree with that. The decisions that the review board needs to make are based on technical considerations.
That was my defense last night. And then I said, we do nothing with enforcement. But I just wanted to convey that to people.
Changing the subject, going back to the May agenda, I'd like to have the Condon residents included in that list. That's one that was deferred earlier. I did submit it to Hi-Crist in time, but the nomination didn't attach. I have subsequently reattached that to Hi-Crist, but I'd like to have that included in the May meeting if possible. That's the one, if you recall, Paul, that you went out to visit. They have finished the work, and I think it's still eligible, so I've revised the nomination to reflect the current status.
Hi, Don. Yes, your nomination will be on the meeting for the next meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Chandra.
Mm-hmm.
So, to clarify, the purpose of this list is to allow the board to get limited meetings at these locations. This is not sort of to prejudge what the actual. You'll need. If the board wishes to have a limited meeting, visit those sites, it needs this information, for the purpose of requesting that, the limited approval of a limited meeting from the Office of Information Practices.
Okay. So can we add that to tomorrow's agenda? I'll make that suggestion at the start of tomorrow's agenda that we add in the limited meetings.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you need to make the request as a board prior to the close of the meeting, but you can do it any time during the meeting.
Okay, well, we should probably do that now then.
Yeah, I'd just like to add another note. The reason why these rather wealthy properties are being nominated and approved is because the people have money to pay people who are more or less experts in the field of filling out the nominations and doing the research and everything. It's not for the average American or average Hawaii home, I should say, or the plantation style house or any of those things, for those people to have the means by which they can put their properties on the register. This is what's you know, this is a this is kind of skewing of the Hawaii State Preservation Division original intentions was to put historic properties on. And if things are so complicated for the nomination to get to do the nomination and then to also go through the high CRIS system and everything, it's just really limits the number of people that actually are going to be served by this.
Okay, thank you, Laura.
I did mine all by just gratis, you know, there's no payment or anything.
Agreed. And we do have a number of people who do their own nominations, and certainly it's not easy, but they do make the effort and nominate their own properties.
And again, bearing in mind that the board has decided to use the National Register standards, and while the National Register started out claiming, you know, anybody with a high school education should be able to fill out one of these forms. And I think over time, that's probably true if that person with a high school diploma wants to spend a lot of time and effort on it, it probably can be done. But, you know, over time, the National Register has sort of upped the ante on a pretty consistent basis to where we are today. And, you know, I don't disagree with anything that Laura has said. You know, it is very difficult for non-professionals to get through this process. And, you know, that I wish that wasn't true. I wish the National Register would come to their senses. I will get off.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Donner. And thank you, Laura. I'd like to get back to the limited meeting request. If somebody on the board would like to make a request to have limited meetings for May 19th.
Yeah, I move that we are allowed to have a limited meeting in May based on safety, privacy, and accessibility to these residences we may want to visit.
Thank you, Matt. Any second? Okay, Paul seconds. Any discussion? Okay, vote please on having a limited meeting prior to the May 20th meeting, so on May 19th for these properties. All in favor? Thank you. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, we'll see you all tomorrow, 9:30, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Thanks, everybody. Susan, Chandra, thanks. See you tomorrow. Thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yep. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Turn be Goran.